welcome back to the show. So Titra, you were an early supporter of the show, and you came on the podcast. Welcome back. I am very happy to talk to you. Congratulations. Today is the day your book is published in the U.S. Congratulations.
Yes, yes, yes. As a brown immigrant, I've made it.
You now have a place in the Library of Congress.
I do. I have a place in the Library of Congress. I do. I don't know. I mean, it just sounds, I don't know. It's great to have a book out, but also I think it's important for all of us to keep talking about how hard it is to get so many of our stories out. And I think that's a very important part of all of these conversations that you do. So great to be here. And also, the last time we had this conversation, I think it was one of the greatest, funnest. I know it's not the perfect English, but it's the greatest, funnest, amazing conversation I've had. So I'm glad to be here.
Aw, thank you, Sitra. That's very sweet. I remember we left the studio in Williamsburg, and we got on the subway, and it was like the most packed, fucking stifled subway you've ever been on. It was like the cliche of New York experiences. And we were talking, and that was a great conversation. I'm so happy that you came back on for a follow-up. But why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about this book, Midnight's Borders?
Sure. I am Suchitra Vijayan. I'm a lapse lawyer and a writer and a researcher. My book, Midnight's Borders, A People's History of Modern India, is result of 10 years of madness, if one would call it. It started with me going to Afghanistan in 2010, between 2010 and 12, for a very different reason. And then I started traveling along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, which kind of helped me think through the war on terror, what was happening, the so-called insurgency. And at the end of it, I decided that what would I find if I traveled across my home country, India's land borders? And is there a way for me to tell a story of a nation still making, remaking, rearranging herself through the stories of making of these borders, but also people affected by these borders, people who live by these borders? And end of 8 years, we have the book, and it's called The People's History of Modern India.
So the premise of the book I always have to talk about genres, because this is the curse of my brain and my training. So everybody who comes on this podcast occasionally has to suffer through these kinds of questions. But the generic thing of your book is kind of neat, because, you know, there's a lot of different ways to sort of tell the story, India. Like, these are all sort of like, you know, these are pretty hollow phrases at this point. Like, I hate to say it, but it's true. Like, how do you tell a story? What story? India's a big country, 1.5 or like 1.5 billion. Like, it's a lot of people. Like, so how do you do that? And your kind of narrative framework is very literal, in the sense that you're doing a kind of pilgrimage book, but instead of going somewhere, you're circumnavigating something. So it's not like, Canterbury Tales, going with the crew of freaks, or, you know, the Islamic version of going to Karbala or Hajj or something. Like, but you're doing a roundabout walking tour of this place that you're from, right? That you've lived most of your adult life outside of?
Yeah, that's true, because I left when I was 17, and I went to school in England, and then I lived in London briefly when I was studying for my bar, and I then left to Hague, and then to Arusha, and then to Cairo, and then Kabul, and then finally San Francisco, and then it's now I live in New York. So for someone like me who is also, I've always had an Indian passport. I just got my American passport last month, and it's so weird. I don't know what to do with it. So when you're traveling brown, there is a very specific way, but also acknowledging that not all brown people have the capacity to travel, especially with a passport. So in the beginning of the book, I talk about my clients who had to go through the indignities of the Mugama in Egypt, in Cairo, for just renewing their stay visas. And I also had to do that. But the reality was that no matter how much one goes through, I still had a passport. I still could decide, you know, the time of my leaving and arrival. So this travel was acknowledging the deep differences that exist as a way of a passport regime, the border controls, and those are all racial. They are hierarchical. And even within that passport systems, while having an Indian passport sucks, I did have a passport. And the percentage of Indian citizens who have a passport is very minute. So at one point, it's understanding that my body is racialized, but also at the same time, as an English-speaking South Asian woman from a certain class, I also had certain privileges that many, many millions of Indians don't. And acknowledging all of that, I was returning home. I didn't want this to be another Anglophone voice interpreting India for a white audience. That's often how our stories get told. I didn't want to be an eloquent voice of the empire. I really had to teach myself to write. I know it sounds counterproductive that, you know, you want to write a book and then you're going to teach yourself to write a book. But that's what I did. I really had to get rid of so many of the bad habits I had picked up over the years. And then just make sure that also a lot of travel writing becomes about the traveler, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want this to be about bearing witness. I really didn't want this to be about giving voice to the voiceless, because as I say in the book, the people in this book are eloquent, eloquent storytellers. They can articulate for themselves their predicaments, their histories. What I was really trying to do was, through their stories, make a structural critique of the nation state, territorial sovereignty, urge people to think. I also didn't want this to be preachy, so I wanted to urge people to think about what it means to be a citizen, but also a very fundamental question that all of us have been, all of our colonial nations and those who fought for the freedom for over the last 100 years have asked, can we think about freedom outside the bounds of territorial nationalism? And I think these stories are an interesting way for us to think through them. And if people can be empathetic and generous and just listen to these stories, and I think perhaps there is a way for us to think about it. And I think that's all one can hope in terms of the travel and the pilgrimage. But yeah, it's definitely not Canterbury Tales.
Yeah. What, you know, Wives of Bath? Like, it's interesting because like you're circumnavigating the inside of this country, right? And in doing so, you see, I mean, like all borders are fake, right? Like all countries are fake, all borders are fake. Some less fake than others, I can happily say. Like the idea of traveling, though, like and tracing like the line of history drawn over these lands. I mean, it's one thing to do it in a place in a settler colonial context of the U.S.-Canada border, right? To follow the land border between Canada and the U.S. is not a particularly elucidating thing, at least maybe not for me. I live in Canada, whatever, like that's hard to say. But that analogy, but doing what you did though is an act of, as you said, it's an act of sort of understanding the fictionality of the nation state and how these things are created, are written, and the main people holding the pens of this nation state, at least these borders, were not Indian ever, right? Like they were imperial. And I think that's just as much true for an Iranian as it is for someone, a modern Indian or Pakistani, or right, what we share all these things is that the territorial sovereignty that our post-colonial countries enjoy, or at least our sovereign countries in a post-imperial world, whatever that means again, or at least a post-colonial world, that is something that I guess provides a kind of cocoon for politics, or at least the kind of bordering frame of politics, right? So like in the Iranian case, it's USA, stay the fuck out, right? Or foreigners, stay the fuck out. Imperials, stay the fuck out. Now, I'm sure that's not the case in India, but it is kind of in a sense in India. I mean, I guess depends on what you call foreigner. And that's kind of, we'll get to that question. But this is a roundabout way of saying that, like, the lines that you studied in this book, and you do it, and you do a kind of national tour, you do a kind of international tour through the different countries. Like, that's the chaptering of the book that I noticed, is that you pick the different relations to the other side as the framing, as opposed to just say like, oh, and then I got on my thing and here's my next stop, right? Is that you use the books, you use the international relations of India and its direct neighbors to frame the writing and the sort of chaptering of your book, which I think is pretty cool. Again, you sort of avoided the travelogue problem of making it about you, as you said, but you also found a way to sort of let a kind of natural thing unfold, natural in the sense that you're finding some nature determined barrier. But like, my question also would be like, how did you manage like the actual like physical, like how did you manage the actual sort of like travel in the sense that like this is not the easiest places to reach, right? Especially in some parts of the book where, and although I was interested to know that like the Myanmar border, right, is not heavily militarized.
Uh-huh. True.
And compared to Jammu and Kashmir, right?
Right.
Which is heavily militarized, which is, you know, one is not, yeah, like, so there's a whole, anyways, I wasn't even a question, but like, could you talk about your decision-making into doing all of this? Was it determined by the nature of your travel or did the book's chaptering determine your travel?
Wow. That's a lot. See, that's a lot. That's a PhD thesis.
I want to do like a mixtape of like things that people say in direct response to like my 12 questions that I throw at them all at once. Like a lot of times it's, well, okay, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So I think that one's going to go in.
Yeah, but also, you know, you should do also this Vogue 70 questions, like, who is your favorite oppressor? Who is your favorite? I don't know. Okay, anyways, I'll be a little bit more serious. Okay, the first part of the question is that I think, the first comment about the Canada-United States border, I think you also kind of allude to it, is that it really depends on who is doing the traveling and who is writing. If you saw it from the perspective of not the Indigenous communities, but also the Canada-America pipeline, I think that would be the pipeline also runs along a very specific kind of a natural and a political border. And I think that story is a story that has to be told. A dear friend, Laura Saunders, is a photographer who's been documenting the pipelines in Appalachia. And she talks about these history of resistance and also the ways in which the state and the neoliberal, forces consistently keep extracting from the people, the local people. Also, if you think of Appalachia, you don't think of, protest and resistance against the state. So I think there is a story to be told, but it just really depends on who thinks it is a story and who sees it and who tells it. And as long as we have the one perspective, which still continues to be a lot. Yesterday, I was looking at U.S. publishing numbers. It's still predominantly white. It's still predominantly heterosexual male. People who come from certain kind of privilege. People whose families have benefited from years of institutional privilege of being white. And also those with access to resources, but also capacity to extract resources. And those people still continue to tell and define the social world. So when maybe that person travels, I don't know what they will see. But I think perhaps when you and I travel, also I think increasingly this is something that I'm thinking through. It's an imperfect idea in my head. I reserve the right to change my mind. But I'm also thinking perhaps some of us as children of a post-colonial world, maybe our bodies already are imprinted with a certain way of looking at the world. We come from histories of violence and trauma and dispossession and exile. So perhaps the stories we look for is also a story of universality where we say, this just didn't happen to me, it happened to someone else. Is there a way for us to think through that? Maybe that is something that is there for us. Now, in terms of the book itself, I did a lot of reading and preparing for the travel, but once I got there, everything just went out of the door. The Bengal border was more porous, easy to travel. Once I went to Kashmir, that just completely changed. I had to be in Srinagar, go to Point A, and come back. Just, it's a very different landscape. There is a certain kind of militarization happening in all of these land borders, but they're very different. And I think it's important for us to kind of understand the varying degrees and levels of militarization. Of course, Kashmir is one of the most militarized parts of the world. It's a landscape made of mass graves and camps and checkpoints. But then when you come to the India-Pakistan border, it's completely different. The India-Pakistan border is so different. It's completely excised of people. It's one of the most militarized borders in the world. But also you have the military exercise that happens that also completely devastates local populations. It's also the site of the nuclear blast that happens, two nuclear tests that India did in Pokhran. So in that sense, I think what you're really seeing is the border could also be seen as a very anachronistic timeline of a nation making process. And that's how I thought about it. The structuring came much later. Also, the book is just a very small fraction of all of the things I saw and did. Towards the end of the book, with the CANRC protests happening, a lot of people just didn't want their stories to be told. It became so unsafe for so many people that the book structure actually fell apart by the end of 2019. And I literally had to rewrite the book again in the next few months. So a book is also this, the function of the book is also understanding that not everything made it into the book. There's far more material that didn't make it.
No, that's interesting to know, because I wonder too. I was like thinking about, like, you know, you use the title Midnight's Borders, which is maybe you should explain it. Like can we talk about like the birth of these nation states? Because this is a term that's used often. It doesn't help that the paradigmatic text is called Midnight's Children. Which kind of makes uh-huh. this a kind of maternal, natural, you know, it renders it in those terms of like the nation, you know, the nation, the kind of language of I don't know, whatever, like, you know, filial blood or whatever you want to call it. But maybe you can explain it, why you chose the title.
I didn't choose the title. My agent did. So the credit goes to her. For the longest of time, we had a lot of back and forth. We didn't know what to call it. Initially, I wanted to call it the Borderlands Project, and then it just seemed too vague. We just didn't know. And also, a lot of my friends don't like the title Midnight's Borders. It feels like it's too rushed in. But I was talking to Lucy about the topic, and I was talking to her about how, you know, as a son, my father was born in 1954 after India's independence. He's the first generation of Indians to be born post-independence as independent colonial subjects, independent citizens of India, not as colonial subjects. And my father, for some reason, like all men his age, most men his age, had a certain kind of veneration for Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister. And when I was young, about 12 or 13, he gave me, you know, the selected speeches, world's greatest speeches. And then one of the things he told me, when you're 13 and your dad tells you that there's one of the greatest speeches ever written, you believe it. It takes a while for you to like disagree with it. So my father told me, I mean, he spoke to me about Midnight's, the speech Tryst with Destiny that Nehru makes, where he says, as the world sleeps on the stroke of midnight, India awakes to life and freedom.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny. And now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge. Not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially. At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom. A moment comes, which comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends, and when the soul of a nation, long suppressed, finds utterance. It is fitting that at this solemn moment, we take the pledge of dedication to the service of India and her people, and to the still larger cause of humanity.
The same midnight then gets used by Rushdie to talk about Midnight's Children. And I was talking about the point that the moment of revolutionary freedom was not a moment of revolutionary freedom. We were ambushed halfway to freedom. It was a transfer of colonial power, not true freedom. Ambedkar talks about this, saying that, you know, while India gave people political freedom, it did not translate to social freedom. So for me, midnight is the moment of violent birth, but also the fundamental flaws that were of inequality and difference that already you see becoming codified within the Indian systems. The fact that even today, despite 70 years of independence, the sheer inequality, the way in which people farthest away from power are treated. So those were the reasons. It was also, I think it was a little bit of making fun of the Rushdie title. But people are welcome to take it anyways. They won. But the title, the credit goes to my agent, Lucy, who came up with the title.
I mean, it's understandable. It's an understandable choice, because like India was born at midnight. Like the idea that we have of nation states is like, you know, it's so funny. Like we have, like in the US, they celebrate 4th of July, right? But like, there's no time. Uh-huh. There's no, right. And that's like a signing of a legal document between a bunch of assholes, right? Like who then use that as the name, who define that as their sovereignty to continue with the politics they were doing before, right? Like conquest, right. You know, accumulating power, whatever, right? Like politics continues, right? But like the transfer of colonial power to the birth of the, like to the newly born Indian sovereign nation state, right? Like that project. And then the series of nation states born around them too, right? Like that is, there is a performance at least of reality there. Right. That like there was a whole thing. I mean, it's the same way they did in Hong Kong, right? They lowered the flag, whatever, like, and they still do these flag thing ceremonies at the India-Pakistan border, right? It's like this whole, they have this weird theater that goes on and this performance of, it really is like a performance of sovereignty, you know, and you, so you understand it. I would understand it. Like, and Rushdie's choice makes sense too. The fact that like he used this as a metaphor to describe this network of children thinking all this like in telecommunication with each other or like in their heads, you know, like that is an interesting, that's an interesting idea because like the metaphor is that like that's India, right? Like the idea of India is born in people's heads and that imagined community, you can set your watch to its arrival, right? As opposed to we were colonized before, like our, like Queen Victoria was literally the queen of empress of India until, you know, until she died or whatever, right? Like that, like that's a whole shift in understanding of one's own sovereignty. So I understand the choice, but I guess maybe the question I would have is that like the generation of people born after, like after that moment, right? Like the children of midnight, like those proverbial children, like they're all starting to die off now, right? Like probably COVID is probably getting a lot of those people. Like the people who, not like the people who were born, sorry, like of that moment, but the people who lived through that. I mean, sorry, that was an important clarification. So like the memory of partition is going to fade, right? Like the actual act of partition, right? The consequences are still living with us, obviously. But like the actual drawing of those lines, the physical removal of tens of millions of people, right? Like those violent acts of border making, like they still live inside of people. You talk about it in the book too, right? Like the somebody now living in Toronto actually, and how like that story is, the story of partition is still very much in people's minds now. Do you feel that part of this work is a kind of something that you, the children, like the Midnight's grandchildren, I guess I want to say, or I guess not grandchildren, maybe, I don't know how this works, but like the generation of Indians born now into neoliberal India, into India that's been globalized, whatever. Like that's now part of the world system. Like, you know, that is like, is this your way of kind of collecting those stories before they begin to fade away in great numbers?
You know, my family is not a partition family. I'm from the south of India, so we didn't really go through that kind of trauma of partition like the Punjab and the Bengal region did. While there was an effect. So this project did not really start as a partition project or the memory of partition. But one thing became clear is that people have been resisting the idea of an all-supreme Indian state for a really long time. It's the Sikhs, it's the Muslim communities, whether it's the Dalit, the Bahujan communities, but Tamils, you know, like we've had a, you know, there was an initially a secessionist movement by Tamils as well, saying that even today there is a very strong push saying that as Dravidians, we do not want the Hindi imposition of our culture. So it feels like, you know, communities, entire republics of communities have been fighting the Indian state, which seems to benefit a very certain specific, just as American state benefits a white settler colonial white community. Well, those many of them would not identify themselves as that, but they do benefit. The Indian state, I think, predominantly has benefited a Brahmin, Savarna, upper caste, upper class communities who use the state as a mechanism for personal enrichment. So as long as that keeps happening, as long as your nation that was born out of a struggle for freedom very quickly is now turned into a settler colonial state. I think what is really important is for us to document the histories and memories of resistance to the state. And I think that's what is important. Especially, for example, what India did in the Northeast, what India did in Manipur, what India did in Punjab, what India did in Kashmir. You know, especially with Kashmir now, it's a full-blown settler colonial project. So I think that
can
is
we,
really
sorry,
important.
Can I pause right there for you, though? Because
sure.
That's an interesting concept, because the settler colonial aspect comes from, I don't know if I agree with it either, but I want to see, like, because the settler colonial aspect is it's ethno-nationalist. Right? Like that's the expression of its ethno-nationalism of India is a Hindu state, right? And
right.
Pakistan is a Muslim state and Bangladesh is a Muslim state, right? Like that's something that the identity of India, but except the fact that the majoritarian thinking of India is much, there's consequences to that, not only in terms of the size of the people, because what's the percentage of Muslims in India? Like in the teens? I don't even know, actually. That translates into tens of millions, hundreds of millions, right? Like vast communities of people who are outside of the bounds of the ethno-national state, which I guess is kind of similar to the U.S., right? Like the ethno-national character of the U.S. is forged in white supremacy, but it's not a direct apartheid state. I mean, it sure feels that way to vast swaths of African Americans and Latino, I'm sure. But like the laws are different. But like, is the sort of ascension of Modi the concretization of a nation of a ethno-national project that's been building for 70 years, or is it a aberration? Like, is India destined to be a racist state?
You're trying to get me killed or arrested for sedition. And I tried really hard not to do that in writing this book. Yeah, I mean, India is, look, the thing is this, right? The thing is that nation states, especially nation states that were built on the idea India is a Hindu state. Well, of course, the early Indian constitution envisioned India as a secular state. But early on, you see signs of which a Hindu majority being privileged. India, look, this is a really complicated question. And there's a lot of people far more smarter and more tuned into this to speak about this. Okay, so for example, I think India's Muslim population, I think if I'm not mistaken, a few years ago, India had a little over 200 million Muslims, which is around 10% of the population. Some people call it between 10 and 14% is the number. But also, increasingly, there's now an argument being made that the Hindu silent majority or the silent majority in India, who is a Hindu, right? I think that's also a question. I don't think Dravidians or Tamilians, non-Brahmin Tamilians, think of themselves as Hindu the way, say, those in the north do. And I think India's diversity, even within Hinduism, is being, just as a Zionist state, the Hindutva, Hindu nationalist state, can only have one kind of a Hindu, one kind of a religion, which India's pluralistic, you know, fabric is also kind of been a way of resisting it, but increasingly that's being wiped out. Having said that, I think we have to understand that early on, the constitution was used to control, subjugate people who did not want to be a part of the nation state making process. And increasingly, in a place like Kashmir, Kashmiris will tell you that they've been fighting oppressors since the first Mughal army marched in. So with Article Revocation of 370, I think, yeah, India is a settler colonial state. They're trying to wipe out the Kashmiri Muslim population. The land is being acquired, possessed. Even today, you saw news coming out of the nomadic communities being dispossessed of their lands. So yeah, India is a settler colonial colony, and that's where we are. And I think it's important
for
us.
But of whom, though? Of whom? Like
of the Kashmiri people.
No, but I mean, because it's just, I just like I think of like some of the who was the, was it was it Reza Shah? I think it was the father of the Shah, of the last Shah, and or maybe not, I can't remember. But one of them was violently displaced a lot of the nomadic people for the oil, right? Like for the oil rich regions of like, and I think this is like a. I guess my only hesitation in calling this settler colonialism is that it collapses, let's say, violent, like racist classic policing and in the goal of subjugating a race to a sovereign authority, like with actual settler colonialism, and say the Israeli vein, right? Or say in the 19th century American, like Western vein, right? Like, and I just wonder if that's something that we should kind of keep apart. But I hear what you're saying. Like the goal, they share a goal, right? Like they share a goal in subjugating a people. But like Muslimness is Muslimness a threat in India? I mean, it is in a sense, because there's violence every day. There's violence against minorities every day. But it's not just Muslimness, right? It's the minority. It's a vision of Hindutva that reigns in this government, right? Of like the Modi government, and that is a kind of Hindu supremacist ideology. Like pretty nakedly, right? It's a pretty fair thing to say. It's not a biased thing to say.
Yeah, but an oppressive beast can take many forms. India can be all of these things.
Right.
And I think it's very important for us to, I think you're right. I think we need to push for meanings and definitions. And for me, a settler colonial state is a state that seeks to replace its indigenous population of their land and remove them of their property, remove them of their land. And the occupation is justified in the name of some kind of an ethno-national supremacy. A lot of Kashmiri scholars would argue that India's settler colonial project in Kashmir started way back in 1947. And now we are just beginning to talk about this in the language that it should have been. Second, India can be racist. It can be casteist. A violent, oppressive system can take many forms. And I think it's very important for us to name those forms very specifically in order for us to fight, because then that'll inform the strategies and tactics. But I don't think there is a problem, or I don't think there is a conflation of too many things. And if you're being very precise, I think India's occupation of Kashmir is a settler colonial project. And that is something that I'll stand by.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but I think that I did an episode on Kashmir a long time ago, and I sadly haven't done one since, and I probably urgently should, because in a weird way, you know, in that episode we talked about, the guest on the show, she discussed how, like, you know, this is the kind of Palestine you've never heard of, the Palestine question that, like, you've never heard of this clear sort of majority of indigenous people who are then being imposed on by this outside settler force who are intent on grabbing as much land as possible. So I'm not doubting the actual, the results of all this. It's more like, I think of like the violence required to create the idea of England too. The idea that, you know, you had to, like, all of those kingdoms had to come under a certain rule that existed between, in not just the British Isles, but within the land we call England itself, right? And Wales and stuff. And so like this sort of strange history that gets telegraphed in the post-colonial period. And I guess in the Indian case, it's one that begins with, I guess there is this dream, or like a kind of proto dream of a kind of nationalist multi-ethnic state that then is now devolved into, you know, Modi glad-handing with Benjamin Netanyahu, who's his best buddy in the whole wide world. And, you know, the sort of joke of one of the sort of online jokes of like this recent Gaza war, are all the sort of Indian people on Twitter and stuff prostrating themselves to Bibi Netanyahu and saying, oh, India supports you, right? Like that's become one of the, like, Hindu nationalists have become kind of a bit of a joke online, at least in my small world, in terms of, and I think of, like, this is what Nehru gave us. Like, this is what Nehruism resulted in 70 years later, 75. Like that to me is, I mean, am I wrong? Is this, like, tell me that, like, that can be saved? I don't know. Like I want a kind of global reading here of, like, the India question. Like, does it come back from this brink that it's on? Brink, I mean, it's an ethno-state right now, or it's gearing towards that way. But, you know, can it return to sanity?
The last time a fascist state had to be dismantled, you needed three territorial armies marching into Europe. So, I mean, I predicted this in 2013, and people said I was being too dramatic. What you really have in India is a full-blown authoritarian Hindutva regime. And look what's happening to the BK-16 political prisoners. Look what's happening to the institutions. Look what's happening, the way in which the COVID devastation has been, like their bodies like floating on the Ganges. More than that, this is a fascist regime. It's an authoritarian fascist regime. Even if this regime or this political party is defeated, I think the structures of the state that enable this still stand. In my opinion, there's nothing redeemable about this. And this is, the return is not a return to a status quo. The return has to be something better. And I think that's one thing that I ask in the book is that, can we imagine something better? And not in a very hippy-dippy, hey, the world is going to be so great, but it's a matter of survival. Reimagining a better world, reimagining not only defeating this fascist regime, but trying to build something new. It's an act of revolution, and it's an act of years and years and years of work ahead of us. So that's where I would leave it. I would leave it at the fact that it is really a place where it's once you go fascist, I mean, I don't know what the return is. I mean, look at Germany today. You know, look at all of these fascist countries. Look what happened in former Yugoslavia, right? I think look what happened in Rwanda. I'm not saying that these were fascist regimes. I'm just saying that once a nation and its fabric breaks, it's incredibly hard to. And there's a reason why it broke. It broke because a certain kind of hate was manufactured and sustained. So I would kind of leave it at that and say it's going to be very hard for India to. We shouldn't return to the status quo because status quo wasn't great. But I think it's really time for us to speak about a future, a liberatory future.
Do you think that, I mean, the next Indian general election is like in 3 years or something?
Yeah.
Are we stuck with Modi at least till then?
Yeah, of course.
And there's not going to be a real internal resistance to him, right? Like there's no political wrangling that could bring him down before the next election.
Because
he runs a pretty tight ship, at least from what I can tell.
I mean, he runs a pretty tight, leaky ship, but I don't know. I really don't know. Because the thing is, you know, there are people resisting this regime every single day. That's why there are political prisoners. There are young people. There are people who are, many of them not on social media, on the ground fighting this regime every single day. For the dignity and the welfare and the rights of their people. As long as they keep resisting, I want to believe that an authoritarian stay is always numbered. And also, I know there's this famous thing where the guy in charge of the Berlin Wall, just a few months before the fall of the Berlin Wall, said, oh, you know, the ball is going to last 1,000 years or something, shit like that. So regimes crumble. It's just that it's very difficult for us as we live through history to know when the regime is going to crumble. But here we are. But it's my assessment that there's going to be far more damage done to the body politic of India and the communities before Modi and his regime, even if they are defeated in electoral politics, all the poison and hate that's pumped into the system. The lynchings, like there were like 2 lynchings of Muslim boys just this week, and that's just what's reported. How are you going to go back? And it's like the wounds of partition are being reopened again. How are you going to?
Well, they never healed, clearly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, 17.9 million people moved across the continent. 17.9. We don't even know the right amount of people who died. Right? And these are all, every family that I know has a trauma. My father's cousin brother, he's now 70, read the book. He's a doctor in the United States. He just turned 70. He read my book and he said, you know what? He's part Tamil, part Bengali. And he said, you know what? Only after reading your book, I realized that his own mother also had to flee their home in Bengal in the height of all of this. He's like, I never understood. It was only after reading your book that I realized that my own mother was carrying this. And he says, now I understand why she behaved a specific way. I just said I never connected both of that. So in that sense, even my uncle who is 70 and my grandmother who's in her 90s, alive, the partition is well and ongoing. And even when the generation dies, we're going to take all of this with us. And that's what the last chapter with Natasha is so important, because Natasha says, you know, it finishes with saying that for Natasha's son Kabir and my daughter Mira, it's important for us to really think of a future in which these, I don't know if these wounds can heal, but at least a way for us to think about a future where we can ask for freedom and dignity without being criminalized for it. I think that's where I'll leave it.
Thank you, Suchitra. This was a lot of fun. This was a great conversation. Can you tell us where to find you? Can you tell us a little bit about the Polis Project? You have your own podcast. You want to promote that a little bit?
No, this is your show.
It's okay. So, people can listen to many things. Just not too many. You hear me? Not too many.
Okay. So, what was the question? So, yeah, Polis Project is a hybrid research and journalism organization. We built it as a humanities collective with me, Francesca Rekia, and Asim Rafiki. We are about officially 3 years old, unofficially a little over 4 years old. What we do is we do research and reportage on communities and resistance. And by that, we mean communities in Palestine, to Kashmir, to what happens in Ferguson, to what happens in Yemen and Syria. Our belief is that communities that resist often have far more in common, and that our solidarities should extend across. As a part of Polis Project, we do have a phenomenal podcast, and it's a conversation series, where, again, we bring in some remarkable voices, scholars, writers, thinkers, to think through these issues. And mostly we just try to be good, decent people and build a revolution and burn shit down. So please follow us. And again, thank you for making time and space for me, Sina. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, Suchitra. You're always welcome to the show. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and take care.